That's makeaplan.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up today, today's the anniversary of the Parkland school shooting massacre. We'll talk about that later on in the program. Also, the St. Petersburg Conference on World Affairs is taking place this week in St. Petersburg at the USF St. Pete campus. We're going to be talking with one of the speakers who will be there this afternoon. And in a moment, we're going to talk about Ray Charles and St. Petersburg. Just a note that WMNF ended its fund drive yesterday, and we came up about $17,000 short. We made up some of the difference in the last 24 hours, but we're hoping that if you didn't get a chance to contribute during the fund drive last week, that you'll make a contribution online at our secure website, WMNF.org. And help us close what is now a $16,000 gap. Well, this is 88.5 FM.
Down in St. Pete, Florida, how about my baby there?
That's Ray Charles doing one of his earliest recordings, St. Pete, Florida Blues. The city of St. Petersburg is about to proclaim February 15th. That's tomorrow, Ray Charles Day. The city will embrace Charles as an adopted son. And that song as an official song of the city. And musicians and presenters will gather tomorrow night at Studio 620 in downtown St. Petersburg. One of those presenters is Roy Peter Clark from the Poynter Institute. And Roy joins us on the phone right now. Roy, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Great to be here, and not only a presenter, but also a musician.
You play in a garage band, is that right?
Oh, yes. since the Beatles arrived.
Okay, all right. So you got some credibility on that score, too. So where did this idea come from to try to make St. Pete, Florida Blues? Is it the official song of St. Petersburg?
Well, when I made the proposal, I said that it's a tricky use of language. I didn't say the official song. I said an official song. Why not have more than one if there are there've been efforts over the years, I think, sort of to do that. But I think to kind of give you a sense of where this the energy around this, I remember seeing the mayor of St. Petersburg, Rick Kreisman, back at the Times Reading Festival, and he said hello, and I said hello, and I said, "Mr. Mayor, did you know that in 1950, Ray Charles wrote and recorded a song called the St. Pete, Florida Blues?" And the look, I wish I had a camera to capture the look on his face, because he was so shocked, he was so surprised, and you can see him saying, like, "Why did I not know this?" And I would ask this same question in front of large groups over the last 2 years, and a tiny percentage of people knew about this. Now, it wasn't a secret as much as it was something that was kind of a veiled piece of history, because the song was created early. It never amounted to anything. I mean, it wasn't one of his big or famous hits. But occasionally it was covered by another artist, such as the blues singer Lattimore, who'll be singing it tomorrow night. And finally, the final kind of, I guess the inspiration came from John Capullo, who teaches over at University of Tampa, who wrote Florida Soul, which I think should become the Bible of Florida musical history. And his first chapter is devoted to Ray Charles. And as I was reading that, and he's talking about this moment which Ray Charles has in his own autobiography, where he and a bunch of friends in Tampa, living in Tampa, decided to record their voices, their music, on what was called a wire recorder. And this is the form of recording that preceded sort of reel-to-reel tape in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And he bought this very cheap little recorder. He called it almost like a toy. And they recorded two or three of the songs. And one of the songs had a title, I Found My Baby There, but subsequently became known as the St. Pete Florida Blues. And so what's likely, and this is the idea that kind of just sort of blew my mind, is that the first time that Ray Charles heard his recorded voice as a teenager was with the words, down in St. Pete, Florida, I found my baby there. And I said, that is amazing. And then, of course, over the course of the next two decades, as he became more and more famous, he appeared in the area. He lived in Tampa until he sort of really, his career sort of broke out, and he moved out to the West Coast. But he came back to the Manhattan Casino down in the heart of the traditionally African-American community, played there many, many times, other venues. And there's a wonderful, David Shedden, the historian and archivist at USF, uncovered this news story from 1961 in which he's playing a concert at a festival in Campbell Park in St. Pete. And the writer, Maxine Brown, who was one of the first African-American journalists published in St. Pete in the Times, notes that it's the first time that the power and popularity of the artist began to erase a little bit the color barrier, so that you see images of that moment of Ray Charles playing in the rain and white citizens of St. Pete standing next to black citizens of St. Pete to enjoy the music of the genius.
Well,
so he had a profound effect, and this is an attempt to kind of, you know, celebrate, regain that legacy, and to make up for the sins of segregation and Jim Crow of the past.
That moment in Campbell Park was amazing. That was March 20th, 1961, as you write. You wrote an article in the Times about it. The city was segregated. Everything was segregated. The newspaper was segregated back then. And this was the first time that people, at least as far as we can tell, openly celebrated the same concert? Or
Apparently, there was another event in a different part of the city, in the north end of the city, which maybe made it a little easier for white people to attend, played by the great Fats Domino, you know, another great, great artist. And so it's clear, I think it's clear, especially in the case of Ray Charles, since he was the master of so many different musical genres, including country music, my God, that he was all the, we're talking about a lot about walls these days, and Ray Charles was a bridge builder, right? He was a person who, in his art, found ways to bring people together.
Well, tomorrow the city of St. Petersburg plans to declare February 15th Ray Charles Day, and they're going to do it with a proclamation and a musical evening at Studio 620. And one of the people who will be there is Roy Peter Clark, who is with the Poynter Institute. He's taught writing there for decades. And Roy, are you going to play music there tomorrow night? Are you going to be part of a band?
So we have 15 musicians on a small stage.
And Studio 620 is rather tiny, too.
It's a tiny, it's been sold out venue for someone told me that there's a crush of tickets like a Springsteen concert.
You need to move it to the Palladium or something.
Well, Paul Wilburn is be one of the musicians there as well. So look for like a bigger venue this summer. And my hope in starting this movement was that this would not just be Ray Charles Day, but this would be the beginning of the Ray Charles era, in which the musical history of St. Petersburg and the Tampa Bay area, would find a kind of a new level of energy and creativity.
You know, I always associate Ray Charles with St. Augustine and the school over there that he attended, and maybe Atlanta. I don't associate him that much with Tampa, although I've heard some stories about Central Avenue and Ray Charles. But how much time did he spend here in the Tampa Bay area?
I'm not an expert on that history, but from the things that I've read is that he left the School for the Deaf and Blind in St. Augustine maybe around his 16th birthday and set off on his own, absolutely set off on his own. And the path is Jacksonville, Orlando, Tampa, with some excursions down into Miami. But as a teenager, you know, he found a congenial family, stayed in a rooming house with them, fell in love with a girl, found his way around town without a cane, without a guide dog, and played with white bands, played with black musicians, played all different kinds of music, and I think both Tampa and St. Petersburg can take some pride in his time here. I like to say that in the history of the competition between the two cities, that Tampa got the university and the airport and the football team, and St. Pete got the song.
Well, these days, I think you get the most exciting streetscape in all of the Tampa Bay area, too.
But we appreciate that.
Yeah. So I was in your article that you wrote for the Times a few days ago, you quote his autobiography, and he calls St. Pete, Florida Blues, and it was a nasty little number. What was the context?
Well, I think what he's saying is that by nasty, you know how? Listen, my street credibility isn't maybe what it used to be, but what I would say is that when some musicians say that, oh, that song was bad, they mean that it's good, right?
Yeah.
And when he said nasty, what he was meaning is like the slow blues, right? The slow blues that he had put together, really imitating Charles Brown and other great artists that he was listening to. But what's remarkable to me about the song is that I'm not sure I've ever heard a blues song that was kind of bluer instrumentally, but happier in its lyrics. He is really happy.
Do writers call that irony, or is it?
Ironic juxtaposition, but I doubt if you can find that in the in any blues lyric that I know.
You know, that's it is a very haunting song. I mean, the emotion just rolls out, and the sound kind of like it's like fog that envelops you and takes over.
Yeah, and it's, how shall I say it? At first, it doesn't sound exactly like Ray. And I think this is the fact that he was 19, that he was listening. His heroes were Nat King Cole, Louis Jordan, Charles Brown, and like other, this is true for writers, for athletes, you know, everybody studies everybody else's moves and imitates them until that moment where you find your authentic voice. I remember being at a Christmas party at my house, and we're kind of a musical family, and I was singing a Tom Petty song, and the way I was singing it, it was like as if Bob Dylan were imitating Tom Petty. And my daughter Lauren, who is a very talented artist herself, said, "Dad, please sing it in your own voice." And I said, oh, okay, that's good. And as, when we were growing up, when the Beatles arrived, all the boys from Long Island were singing in an English accent, in a Liverpool accent.
Because they learned to sing along with the song. That's how they first learned how to sing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So tomorrow night, what's going on? And you say that there may be another event this summer. Tomorrow night's event is sold out. But tell us about some of the people who are going to be there tomorrow night and how they would keep in touch to not miss the summer event if it comes off.
Yeah. Well, the great soul artist, blues artist from the 1970s, Lattimore, who did a tribute album, is going to come over and going to sing St. Pete Florida Blues, and we hope a couple, and maybe another number. The great St. Pete treasurer, Alex Harris, one of the most dynamic and versatile vocalists that I've ever worked with, has got a few songs. The Schieber family, Dave Schieber and I played in a rock band of guys from the St. Pete Times for many years, and they're going to kind of highlight the country influences of Ray Charles. Paul Wilborn will be there, and we don't have the Raylettes as such. We're honoring and not imitating the great artist, but we do have a chorus of women, a choir of women who will be singing. Looking at me and singing Hit the Road, Jack. So we think it's going to be fun. We have a few brief presentations to give a little flavor of the history of Ray Charles in the Tampa Bay area. And it's in the middle of right in the middle of Black History Month, which we think is highly significant. And we look for more creative energy down the road.
That's St. Pete celebrates the Florida legacy of the genius Ray Charles tomorrow night, Studio 620, and maybe ticket scalpers will be out there outside. Well, let's hope a big event comes off this summer, because I sense that there, as you said, it's sold out tomorrow night. There's probably a lot of demand to see this great crew, including Lattimore, who's a treasure.
Yeah, he surely is amazing. I've gotten to know his work more as a result of this, and I think he's close to 80, and that voice is just—it's that great. What would you call it? It's that soulful foghorn.
Yeah, it's a classic mm-hmm. blues voice. All right, well, Roy Peter Clark from the Poynter Institute. Thanks a lot,
Rob. Thanks a lot, and thanks to all your listeners, and urging them to make contributions to M&F.
All right, thanks, Roy. Take
bye-bye.
Care. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Let's listen to a little bit more of this. Recording from about 1950, Ray Charles, St. Pete, Florida Blues, and this is WMNF in Tampa.
How about my baby there? Like my baby, any place, anywhere.
Ray Charles here on WMNF 88.5 FM. Well, going on right now in St. Petersburg at the USF St. Pete campus is the annual St. Petersburg Conference on World Affairs. And yesterday I spoke with one of the presenters who's going to be speaking this afternoon. He's a former ambassador. His name is Dennis Jett, and he has served all over the world. In 2008, he became one of the founding faculty members of the New School of International Affairs at Penn State University, following 28 years as a career diplomat in the U.S. Foreign Service and 8 years as the dean of the International Center at the University of Florida. He has served diplomatic posts around the world, as I mentioned, including in Peru, Mozambique. He served in Argentina. He was in Liberia. He was in Israel, South Africa, many, many other places. He's going to be talking about the rise of nationalism. He's also going to be talking about international terrorism. And I got a chance to speak with him yesterday, and here is that interview. Ambassador Dennis Jett, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here and not in Pittsburgh.
You were in Pittsburgh at the time of the synagogue massacre, and I want to start there. Even though you're a foreign policy expert, I think it opens the door to some foreign policy questions. When the massacre happened, did you think that it was the rising tide of nationalism in the U.S. that caused that massacre?
I think there's a lot of definitions of nationalism, and I think it's one of those words where people see it, I think they know what it means, and then it kind of interpret it the way they want to interpret it. But I think in a kind of dark way, if you think nationalism is about xenophobia and racism and anti-Semitism in this case, then yes, the Tree of Life shooting was particularly personal for me because I live in Squirrel Hill, the neighborhood of Pittsburgh where the synagogue is. I live less than a mile from the synagogue. And as I pointed out in an article I wrote, Mr. Bowers, when he decided he was going to go kill some Jews, he had lots of places to choose from in Pittsburgh. He lives about 13 miles to the west of the neighborhood that synagogue is in, but he chose that particular synagogue because it had been identified as working with something called HIAS, H-I-A-S, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. That's an organization that started out 100 years ago helping Jewish people emigrate from areas where they were oppressed and into countries like the United States or Israel to adjust, help them to adjust to life. And a couple decades ago, HIAS switched its direction a bit and said it was going to help not only Jews, it was going to help all refugees around the world to the extent it could to make this change. And the Tree of Life was identified as working with HIAS, and that is why Bauer chose them. And so I think it was a direct result of the kind of anti-immigrant hysteria that pervades our political discourse today. I think I blame the president for that because, you know, the Build the Wall and the Muslim ban, all of that is directed at stoking people's fear. There isn't any crisis on the border. There isn't any significant threat from these people, but he is playing into that feeling of xenophobia, racism, and in Bauer's case, he translated that into anti-Semitism, so he went to that synagogue and not my synagogue, which was half a mile away, and also works with HIAS. And then he killed those people in the bloodiest attack in the United States on Jews in history.
You've lived all over the world as a diplomat. You've been stationed in places like Africa and South America. You've spent time in Israel. Have you seen nationalism in other countries? And could you compare what's going on today in the U.S. to any situation that you've observed firsthand abroad?
Well, I think all countries display a certain amount of nationalism in different ways, but I don't think I've seen anything quite like the nationalism in the United States today in terms of stoking people's fears and arousing the sentiment. It's a convenient mechanism. When I was in some of the countries in Africa, when there was crime committed, it was never the people from that country. It was the people from the neighboring countries who had come in to commit those crimes. That was, at least that's what some of the political leaders said. So, I mean, it's there to tap into, but I think part of the problem is that with this globalized world we live in, there are more people now as refugees than any time really since World War II. I think something like one out of every 110 people on the planet is a refugee. So you have that impact. And it's not limited to the United States. I think the whole Brexit vote was people were fooled about the economic impact of Brexit, but it was an appeal again to the anti-immigrant, xenophobic tendency of British people. The reaction in throughout Europe to the wave of immigrants is also, you know, reflects that. But nationalism is there to be drawn upon. Sometimes it's, you know, for patriotic reasons and positive reasons, but all too often it's for other reasons to motivate people through fear and xenophobia.
We're talking with retired Ambassador Dennis Jett. He's a professor of international affairs in the School of International Affairs at Penn State University, and he's speaking this afternoon at the USF College of Business, the Kate Tiedemann College of Business at 2 p.m., and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. It seems to me that just igniting the feelings of nationalism is like lighting a fire, that you can never tell where it's going to go.
Well, I think that's right. I think when you stir people's emotions up, they don't always result in positive reactions. I think, again, Mr. Bauer's reaction that he decided he was going to go shoot up a synagogue because it was aiding refugees was one of those reactions. And so it's a very dangerous thing. It seems to me there are politicians that appeal to hope and change, like Mr. Obama did. That was his slogan, and we had more hope than he was able to bring about change. But there are politicians who appeal to hate and fear, and I think that's what Mr. Trump appeals to when he talks about building a wall and banning Muslims and a lot of other things.
I want to ask you about foreign relations, the U.S. Role in the world. You're speaking at the St. Pete Conference on World Affairs. Do you think that the U.S. is now more respected since President Trump has come into office? Is it more respected among other countries? Have we enhanced our reputation with other countries, or have we lost reputation?
I would say it was, obviously, you know, your listeners can say, oh, it's just another liberal, but and I admit to that, my politics are liberal, but I would say we are definitely diminished. And you can look at the polls of the views of people in other countries toward the United States, and I think the only place where the United States, or at least the President of the United States, is more popular now than Mr. Trump's predecessor, the only two countries are Israel, at least it was. I'm not sure that's going to last. But Russia was the other country where Trump is more popular than Obama. I think every other country has good reason to doubt our reliability. When Trump says, well, what do we need NATO for? All the NATO countries then say, well, if we get into a situation where we have to call on our NATO allies, is the United States going to be there? This very week, this very day, Secretary of State Pompeo is in Warsaw, Poland, and he's trying to essentially drum up a coalition against Iran, maybe to engage in another useless war or just to pressure Iran. I'm not sure. But I don't know who is going to be willing to follow the United States into the battle when there is a serious doubt about the reliability of the United States. And you can see that in virtually every kind of policy, that, you know, the flip-flopping, the one day it's this, the other day it's that, and the sort of contempt of the president for the whole international architecture of organizations and alliances that have basically produced the kind of world that we live in post-World War II, which is generally one of prosperity and democracy, or it used to be expanding democracy, not so much anymore. But I think definitely the United States' image has suffered as a reliable partner, and people are kind of scratching their heads about where we stand, what we're going to do next, and I think that's only going to continue for the next year or two at least.
We're talking with Dennis Jett. In 2008, he became one of the founding faculty members of the New School of International Affairs at Pennsylvania State University, following 28 years as a career diplomat in the U.S. Foreign Service and 8 years as dean of the International Center at the University of Florida in Gainesville. He'll be speaking this afternoon at 2 p.m. at the St. Petersburg Conference on World Affairs. So there are a lot of hawks in the Trump administration when it comes to Iran. And the president and others have suggested that Iran is the source of terrorism and a creator of problems in the Middle East and in South Asia. And the president withdrew from the Iran nuclear agreement in May. What do you think about the moves against Iran?
Well, Iran is I'm not trying to say Iran is anything but a negative actor in the world. It does support Hamas and Hezbollah, two groups that we consider basically terrorist groups. It does have a nuclear program. I thought it was a mistake to get out of the nuclear agreement because it did provide constraints on Iran's nuclear program. But now, again, we negotiated the Iran nuclear deal with five other countries, or six countries on our side of the table. The permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany. And so now the European countries, France, Britain, Germany, are looking for ways to keep Iran in the deal by giving them the economic benefits that they derive from the deal. And so that's driven yet another wedge between us and our partners. And I'm sure, you know, Russia and China are happy to deal with Iran and trade with Iran as well. So I don't know that that's going to do anything other than make Iran question whether there is any benefit negotiating it at all. I guess if you have a difference of opinion between two countries, you can either negotiate and pursue it through diplomacy, you can go to war, or you can ignore each other. And you can also try sanctions, which is what the United States is doing now, but the sanctions only work if you have broad buy-in from all the other countries that are potential trading partners. And so it's very difficult to have effective sanctions if you don't have pretty much universal acceptance of those sanctions. So I think it was a mistake to get out of the Iran nuclear deal. I think there are things we need to address about Iran's behavior with regard to its influence in the Middle East. But I think that forming a coalition in Poland is going to have limited success in that regard. And essentially what we need to do is attempt to pressure Iran in some ways, but also to have some dialogue with them. You know, Iran has its view of the bilateral relationship as well. For us, for the Americans, it's all about taking the embassy people hostage when the Shah fell, and then maybe if people have seen Argo, the movie, they think of that. For the Iranians, it's our overthrowing their democratically elected leader, Mr. Mossadegh, back in 1953. It's shooting down an Iranian airliner under George H.W. Bush and refusing to even apologize, even though the airliner was filled with a couple hundred, you know, civilians, women, children, etc. And then we supported Iraq in the war between Iran and Iraq, and about a million Iranians died in that war. And we had, in fact, a special envoy of the Reagan administration to go cozy up to Saddam Hussein in our efforts to support Iraq in that war against Iran. That special envoy's name was Donald Rumsfeld. So, and we gave them that intelligence and support and financial support, and didn't complain too much when they used chemical weapons against the Iranians and even against their own people. So there is two different versions of the relationship, and I think we have to take that into account when we attempt to deal with Iran.
Would it be fair to say that the U.S. has while it's been critical of Iran under President Trump, it's largely been silent about the role of Saudi Arabia in that part of the world, and Could you comment about Saudi Arabia's support for terrorism and Saudi Arabia's internal domestic policies when it comes to women and human rights?
Yeah, ironically, you know, there is a kind of small improvement in Saudi Arabia in terms of rights. I mean, women can now drive. But in terms of political expression, it's gotten more repressive than ever. And then, of course, they lured Mr. Khashoggi into the consulate in Turkey and then murdered him and dismembered him. And the Trump administration, even though everybody's pretty much, all the intelligence agencies have concluded that there's no doubt that this was done by the Saudi government and probably at the highest levels, including Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the Trump administration hasn't been pressing on that. In fact, the Congress asked or requested of the administration a report on the Khashoggi killing, which I think was due yesterday, and the Trump administration has just blown the Congress off and ignored that request. I think part of the problem with having a president who has extensive business interests that he hasn't relinquished or even revealed, as you have to wonder, is the attitude toward Saudi Arabia influenced by the fact that them and their friends rent or buy condos in Trump buildings and reserve hundreds of rooms in Trump hotels. The other area of Saudi Arabia policy that is very worrisome is in Yemen. There, in the old days of the Cold War, the United States and the Soviet Union used to get into proxy wars in countries like Angola, where you'd have horrific humanitarian cost. Now it's Saudi Arabia fighting Iran, basically Sunni Muslim Saudi Arabia fighting Shia Muslim Iran in a place like Yemen. It's the biggest humanitarian catastrophe in the world, and the Saudis, of course, are using American weapons, American airplane, American bombs, and up until fairly recently were being refueled in midair by American jets. The Saudis are also apparently renting child soldiers from North Africa to send into the fray, because they're not going to put their own troops on the ground. They'll put their planes in the air over Yemen, but not any troops on the ground. So I think that's particularly worrisome when you have millions of people at risk of starvation and disease and everything else because of this proxy war that's being conducted. So yeah, I think there's plenty of reason to be concerned about what Saudi Arabia is doing and why. But again, and if we're ever to, Saudi Arabia is an important player, though, in the Middle East, and so we need to have some agreement and support from them in what we're trying to achieve in the Middle East. But that doesn't mean giving them a blank check when it comes to murdering political opponents or putting millions of people at risk in Yemen.
One last question. That is, the president said the other day that ISIS has been defeated, and he's planning to, or at least said, we don't know if this is true, planning to pull U.S. troops out of Syria. Has ISIS been defeated? Is that a good move to pull troops out of that part of the country and or part of the world, rather? And also, are any forces within Saudi Arabia itself funding ISIS and encouraging ISIS in any way?
As for the last question, it's hard to say where these organizations, these terrorist groups, get their funding. There's a lot of sympathy for them in all the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia. And sometimes, you know, these days, one of the ways you can become a group like this is you put your video on social media and people, if people send you money, then you're in business. And so I would think that the Saudis are trying to limit the financial support, but that's not easy. Is ISIS defeated? Well, they've been, the territory they occupied has been taken back almost entirely. They occupied that territory because they wanted to set up a caliphate, their own little, they wanted to act like a government and control territory. And when they did that, in my definition, they became insurgents more than terrorists. The advantage that terrorists have is they're indistinguishable from the civilians and therefore can hide among the civilians and carry out their act of terrorism. Once you're an insurgent and try and take and control territory, then you sort of set yourself up to be attacked in a conventional military sense. And we did that. The ISIS took over this territory because the Iraqi army that we've been training for years refused to fight. And so it took American air power and Kurdish militias to take back that territory from ISIS. But ISIS will just revert to being a terrorist organization. And so have they been defeated? Well, they've lost their territory, but they're still around. And, you know, anybody can commit a terrorist act and say, oh, I belong to ISIS. I agree with ISIS's philosophy. So as long as there are people willing to use terrorism, it's a tactic. You don't defeat a tactic. And as long as there's people willing to kill innocent people to make a political point, then you're going to have ISIS or some other group. And so we have to be kind of wary about running around the world trying to play whack-a-mole with every terrorist group that pops up, because it's not that big a threat, and it's easy to kind of dissipate all our resources and energy and to ask things of our military that they really can't accomplish. And so, yeah, ISIS is defeated but not eliminated, and it doesn't make all that much difference anyhow, because they're going to be around in one form or another. And I think the only way to prevent these terrorist groups from taking root in a lot of these countries is to have better governments in those countries that are not governments that are not corrupt and repressive, and governments that care about the welfare of their own people.
And before we go, does any foreign policy situation keep you up at night? Maybe that some situation that we've been ignoring that has the potential for a wider conflict or to create a wider problem? Is there any area of the world that you look at and think the U.S. is not paying attention or has taken the wrong stand?
I guess there's probably two. I mean, Pakistan is always a concern because it has nuclear weapons and it has a democratic government, but with tenuous control and always challenged for power by the military. I'm not sure what the answer to that problem is, but it's one that needs attention. Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of the president, is going to be rolling out his peace plan, maybe tomorrow, maybe whenever. He's supposedly going around the Middle East now, telling at least the economic aspects of the plan. I'm sure it's going to be a non-starter, because I don't think they've taken the Palestinian point of view into account. They think that if they can shower enough economic benefits on Palestinians, that they won't care about their identity and lack of having territory or a country of their own. But one of the problems I see is you've got the situation in Lebanon, where Hezbollah basically controls southern Lebanon. According to the Israelis, tens of thousands of rockets are now been emplaced by Hezbollah in civilian population centers. And so if there's a confrontation between Hezbollah and Israel, Hezbollah fires rockets into Israel. Israel will respond with massive bombing, and it won't be able to avoid collateral damage, as we like to euphemistically call killing civilians. And so that, I think, has a potential for being a very bloody conflagration. And we have a peacekeeping force there, but of 10,000 troops costing $500 million a year, but they aren't doing anything but driving around and waving at people, because they have no mandate to provide a police role, meaning stopping and searching cars or going into houses and searching houses, because that's supposedly left to the Lebanese government. But the Lebanese government, Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government and controls three of the ministries of the Lebanese government, and controls, as I said, southern Lebanon. So it's not doing any good, and I think that situation has a potential, as some places in the Middle East do, of rapidly spinning out of control.
Well, Ambassador Dennis Jett, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF. I really appreciate your insights.
Yeah, my pleasure, Rob. Thanks. Anytime.
That's retired Ambassador Dennis Jett. He'll be speaking in St. Petersburg this afternoon as part of the St. Petersburg Conference on World Affairs. His talk takes place at 2 p.m. at the Kate Tiedemann College of Business Auditorium on the USF St. Pete campus. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. I'm Rob Lori. Thanks for tuning in. And we're going to open up the phone lines if we can. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. We're going to hear a segment from one of the films that we were offering from the WMNF Fund Drive. That's the Michael Moore film, Fahrenheit 11/9. And the film weaves together several different storylines, including the story of the Parkland shooting. It was 1 year ago that a gunman killed 17 students and educators at the Parkland High School, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland in South Florida. Since then, there have been nearly 350 mass shootings in the U.S. And I want to ask you, what have we learned since Parkland? And have we made the world a better place? Let's go to Michael Moore's film, Fahrenheit 11/9. And by the way, this film is still available for a donation of $100 to WMNF. You can make a contribution online and get the entire film. We'll hear a seven-minute segment from it. But you can donate at WMNF.org and help us make up that $17,000 shortfall that we ended the fund drive with yesterday.
All right, so here's the plan. I'm going to go.
What we're about to hear is something disturbing. We're going to hear the gunman making plans to shoot up Parkland. So some of this audio may be disturbing to some people.
Take an Uber in the afternoon before 2:40. From there, I'll go into the school campus, load my bags, and get my AR-15 and a couple trace rounds. Wait, and people will die. Location is Stone Douglas in Parkland, Florida.
And, like clockwork, came the thoughts and prayers.
Thoughts and prayers.
And our thoughts and prayers.
In our thoughts and prayers.
Quote, our thoughts and prayers.
Thoughts and prayers.
Our thoughts and prayers.
Our continued thoughts and prayers go out to all.
And they always tell us not to make these shootings political. A group of teenagers said, well, that's the end of that. They decided to make it political because it was political.
In response to President Trump, I would say this. You want to look back on our history and blame the Democrats? That's disgusting. You're the president. You're supposed to bring this nation together, not divide us. How dare you? Children are dying, and their blood is on your hands because of that.
I'm going to happily ask him how much money he received from the National Rifle Association. United States in the 1.5 months in 2018 alone, that comes out to being $5,800. Is that how much these people are worth to you, Trump? They say that tougher gun laws do not decrease gun violence. We call BS! They say a good guy with a gun stops a bad guy with a gun. We call BS! They say that us kids don't know what we're talking about, that we're too young to understand how the government works. We call BS!
To all of the generations before us, we sincerely accept your apology. And we appreciate that you are willing to let us rebuild the world that you f***ed up.
These fearless kids are on fire, and the fire was spreading. 1 month after the shooting, there was a national student walkout day. But this middle school principal didn't want to let the kids off campus.
Basically, just all ran out. I'm not sure they're letting us
really organize.
They can't expel everyone here because that's insane.
Westlade, you may go back to second period.
We were able to go because so many people, there's one person can't stop at least over 500 kids.
Westlade's middle school, you may go back to second period at Westlade.
The tweens had tasted power. And they now knew that the adults are, well, kind of just a bunch of ineffective dweebs.
We want change! We want change!
This was a bona fide political movement, and I was there to see it for myself. The Parkland students invited me in to their secret headquarters.
I think it's just insane to think that within a month of this happening, the pace that we've gone at, we have an international NGO that we're running out of an office space in the same city now. Running
22 students.
Being run by 23 walking hormones with probably a lot of ADD in between.
I don't know if it was the hormones or the ADD, but the international march they were organizing was taking off.
What's up to it's at 820. Yesterday it was at like 760 something. That's like several more marches in a day.
My generation, the generation after me, maybe we did one thing right. We raised you.
Well, on the contrary, social media raised us.
Yes.
My phone.
And like, you see it like...
Communicating with other young people.
Yeah.
About what the real truth is.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the fake news networks, CNN last night, was saying, I want teachers to have guns. I don't want teachers to have guns. I want certain highly adept people that understand weaponry, guns. If 20% of the teachers have guns, it may be 10% or maybe 40%. We need to let people know, you come into our schools, you're gonna be dead, and it's gonna be fast.
This is about us demanding change, and this is about the fact that we have already won. It's just a matter of when.
Thrust into instant activism, the students went to the place where change is supposed to happen. The state capitol building in Tallahassee, one of the few places in Florida where you're safe from guns.
He didn't even reach 18 years old yet. He was a boy who got shot in the head because of your law saying that an 18-year-old boy can carry a military A weapon to kill.
The students were impeccably prepared. Some of the legislators, not so much.
You can shoot as many bullets with a handgun as you can with these rifles.
But civilians with such high-capacity magazines, do you support that?
When you say high-capacity magazines, that's the number of...
bullets.
Yeah, I've heard different positions on that.
All we want is an answer as to how are we going to fix this and continue our life not living in fear.
Yeah, it's going to take a lot. It's going to take a lot. It's going to be multifaceted bullet points of coming in from all kinds of different angles.
Government is set up to move slow, okay? There's committees, there's dual houses. It's not like cutting grass. Cutting grass, you can immediately turn around and see this is the product of what I've done. But
what's your personal stance on assault-style weapons like an AR-15?
Yeah, it's a head-scratcher where we are. So it's going to be... It's going to be a debate. I've always defended people's right to defend themselves. I haven't got specifics, so you're asking me specifics yet, Jake, and I don't know. But
they quickly learned that asking for help from a politician who gets an A-plus rating from the NRA gets you nowhere.
Take the camera for me.
You need to challenge them directly.
Senator Rubio, can you tell me right now that you will not accept a single donation from the NRA in the future?
That is the wrong way to look. First of all, the answer is people buy into my agenda.
You can say
number
no.
Second, well, I...
Or another option is to vote them out, even if you're too young to vote.
I get tweets from people. They're like, hey, I'm a mom from Tennessee. I've never voted before, but I'm going to vote now.
Yeah. So you're getting, so people that who are non-voters
yes.
are telling you...
I'm going to vote.
At all these marches, we're having...
booths to register yourself to vote, because we know that we're going to be the generation that are going to vote those people out.
That's from Michael Moore's film Fahrenheit 11/9. One of the premiums that we were offering during our fund drive, you can still get that documentary on a DVD for a donation of $100. You can make your contribution at WMNF.org. Coming up in the next hour, the Midpoint program looks at love in the courthouse on this Valentine's Day, and also domestic violence. They'll be talking about that in the coming hour. Stay tuned. If you want to comment about today's show, call us up, 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. I'm Rob Lori. This is WMNF in Tampa.